Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Felix Wong graduated from the Peabody Conservatory, where we missed each other by a year but both studied with Stephen Cates, the New England Conservatory, and got his doctorate from the University of Michigan. He is a member of the Blair String Quartet, a founding member of the Blakemore Trio, and is co-principal of the Iris Orchestra. He has been on the faculty of Vanderbilt's Blair School of Music since 1999. Thank you so much for joining us for our third episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun. I think it's a great idea for this podcast.
Thank you. I looked around online. I like to try and get as much information about people that we interview ahead of time, and I couldn't find much more than sort of your musical experience and music background. And I think people always like to know, where did you grow up, and was music an important part of your family and childhood?
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, I grew up in Michigan, in a town called Okemos, Michigan, which is right next to East Lansing, so a suburb of the capital of Lansing, Michigan. And that's where I was born, and that's where I lived all the way through high school, and sort of mid-Michigan area. And there was a wonderful Suzuki teacher there, Marilyn Kessler, who started me. And then I started taking lessons in middle school from Louis Potter Jr., who was a retired professor at Michigan State.
And how old were you when you started?
I was 5. I mean, I started with the Suzuki method. The Suzuki method in the States was really quite new at that point. And my teacher was very instrumental in starting up the whole trend, and she was one of the ones that was helping to make the Suzuki books early on.
So when you say Suzuki, does that mean that one of your parents actually learned the instrument along with you? Was it the traditional method in that manner?
Well, yeah. I mean, they basically it was my father. He would sit there with me at every day that I would practice, and he would take notes during the lesson and then incorporate what Ms. Kessler was asking me to do during the week of practice. So every day we'd sit down as soon as he got home from school and sit down for like 20, 30 minutes, and then that'd be it.
And were you the one who picked the cello, or was that something your parents thought it would be nice to see you play?
Well, it's a funny story, because I think my father went to Marilyn Kessler, who was the director of the Suzuki program and a cellist herself, and just said, you know, I want to sign my son up for some violin lessons. And she said, oh, that'd be fine. But, you know, I was wondering if he might not be interested in the cello too. We've got a lot of violinists in our program right now, and we're trying to get our cello program going. And my father, who was a big fan of both David Oistrakh and Rostropovich, was fine with the cello. It ended up being the cello that I played. And it's funny that I didn't even know this story until I had already graduated from high school, and I'd come back to play a recital in my hometown. And Ms. Kessler came up to me and said, you know, wasn't it good and lucky that I asked your dad if you'd be willing to play the cello instead of violin? And I said, what? And I had this sort of, oh my God, one little thing like that. It's funny in life how everything can just pivot. And that was a moment. So
was it a struggle for you to practice every day, or did you come to it just fine?
Well, I really did like the cello. I mean, I certainly didn't love practicing, but I realized pretty early on that my dad's will was a lot stronger than mine. I didn't fight him as much when I was younger. I just knew when he got home, okay, we'll pull the cello out. And honestly, the practice sessions went by pretty quickly. He was very good at that, and just sort of follow the directions and get me to do what I needed to do. And, you know, 30 minutes was gone in a heartbeat, actually. And the whole practice thing became more difficult when he was no longer practicing with me, you know, so then it was up to my own self-discipline. And I was still pretty good about it. I was in a groove, but, you know, the practice sessions were sometimes, I suppose, hit or miss if I wasn't really focusing or concentrating.
Yeah. And what age did you start practicing on your own then?
It was middle school at that point. I think when I had left Ms. Kessler and then I started studying with Louis Potter, that's when I started taking a little bit more responsibility. He would still come to my lessons, and because just the process of taking me there didn't make sense for him to then turn around, go home, and then come right back again. So he just sat there quietly during the lesson. He would take notes for me and stuff, and I could refer back to those. But he no longer was actually there when I was practicing.
But just to clarify, he was not a cellist at all before these lessons, or did he know a little bit about it?
No, he really didn't. I grew to know that he actually has a wonderful ear. He was always very good with languages and became very interested in Russian as well. And so that was part of the spark with Oistrakh and Rostropovich. But no, there was no background. I think he tried to teach himself the violin a little bit, but I don't think that lasted very long.
And that would be tough.
Yeah.
So chamber music's obviously a large part of your life, and it's obviously important to you. How did you end up being in two groups, not just one?
Well, so I ended up at Vanderbilt because the Blair String Quartet, well, the Blair School of Music was sort of founded with this quartet in mind as being central to the faculty. And so the quartet has been in existence since 1967, I believe. And so the School of Music at Vanderbilt didn't really actually even begin until 1987. Or maybe it was 86. And so the quartet was part of that faculty. So when they called me in 1999, it was to join the quartet, but also to join the faculty at Vanderbilt. And I went down and I read with them and I ended up getting the job. And then a couple years later, my wife, Carolyn Hubel, who's a wonderful violinist, was teaching up at Carnegie Mellon and playing in the Pittsburgh Symphony. The Blair School kind of needed another violinist at that time. And we were like trying to figure out how we were going to get together in the same place. We'd been living apart now for 2 years. Vanderbilt was really flexible and wonderful about having her join our faculty. They kind of saw an opportunity. And so she moved down and then we played a trio concert with our wonderful pianist, Amy Dorfman, just for fun. And then we thought, hey, maybe we'd like to do this on a more steady, consistent basis. And so another year later, we decided to go ahead and make that a regular thing.
So let's talk about pre-pandemic first. What did that look like playing in both of those groups combined with your teaching schedule? How many concerts were you playing a year? And
well, you know, it varied. I mean, the schedule could be pretty crazy because I would rehearse typically about 12 to 13 hours a week with the quartet. And then the trio just 5 or 6 hours a week. And then I could have as many as, at one point, 17 students, but more typically 12 to 13, maybe 14 right now. The amount of contact hours that I was logging was quite heavy. And then, you know, with university, there comes a lot of other responsibilities. And then I've got to find time to practice. And I have 3 kids too. So it ended up being quite a bit to do. The quartet, and we kind of go in and out of being really busy or having more of a spare landscape. But those earlier days, we would always give one recital at Blair each semester, at Vanderbilt each semester. And then we would take that program on the road with us. And usually it might be anywhere from 5 to 6 concerts a semester, maybe 10 to 12 a year outside of Nashville. And then the trio, we would just typically do 1 concert a year, and then we would take that with us, and we would have 3 or 4 concerts outside of Nashville. So I found it to be a nice balance. I love the teaching part of things. I love having a wide variety of things to do. And so I feel extremely lucky to have been able to get to know the quartet literature and the piano trio literature really well.
Yeah, and I'm sure this also shapes how you teach your students and things that you focus on, since chamber music is such a core part of our repertoire and being, really, as a cellist.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what does that concert schedule look like now? How have you been coping with the pandemic?
Well, it's been extremely spare. We've just been doing the concerts at Blair. We haven't been traveling at all, and the concerts that we had lined up last year all got canceled. And at this point, we're going to try to get back on our feet. Even just a little bit of opening up, as I'm sure you experienced as we were talking about in the fall, boy, that was really important and meaningful to kind of get going again and to be able to see my students in person. But I remember the first quartet rehearsal after the summer, and we're just looking at each other, and we were spaced, you know, 6 or 7 feet apart, and we were wearing masks, but It was a
can't hear anything.
Yeah, I know. I was like, you know, you guys aren't really together. Oh, we aren't. I have no idea, you know. But that was wonderful to be able to come back and to make music with colleagues.
Are you teaching your students live now?
We are. So Vanderbilt did start in person in the fall, and we have all kinds of protocols. My studio is relatively large, so I can actually be 10 to 11 feet distance, and then we're both wearing masks. I also have a big shield. So my office feels pretty safe. And then the protocols that are in place around the school feel good too. And the university has done pretty well. The rate of infection is low. And it's, I think we've determined that when there are outbreaks, I've had various students go into quarantine and even one catch COVID, but the protocols are pretty good. And we've, I think, have mostly determined that they're not getting it in the school setting. It's, you know, it's the gatherings and the things that happen outside.
So tell us then about your music program at Vanderbilt. We spoke in our last episode with David Gaber about attending Manhattan School of Music and a conservatory and what the difference might be there versus a university program. And I'd be interested to see from your perspective what Vanderbilt is like versus a conservatory. And since you've been to both kinds of schools, you probably have your own unique perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Vanderbilt is a prestigious academic institution. I think we're a top 15 school right now. And I think that's an attraction for most students. When they apply, they're really wanting that collegiate experience. And so, like most universities, the music school is its own community. And so it's nice because you can take a larger institution and find some intimacy. And Vanderbilt is not as large as, say, I went to the University of Michigan. It's like 30,000 undergraduates. Vanderbilt's 6,500 undergraduates. But that's still a lot of people. And then the Blair School is very small. It's only like 220 because we only have undergraduates in our program. It's definitely its own little community. You probably recognize everybody within 3 or 4 weeks. You may not meet some of them your entire time, but you'll kind of recognize them in the halls. The ability to have that home base, that school of music, and then be able to have the collegiate experience is, I think, a wonderful thing. And I think the fact that we're undergraduate only, our music school, is a very powerful tool. I think the students really feel the same. You know, they go through the same things. They commiserate. Friday, we have a recital hour and they all get together and there's all kinds of energy and the student council has announcements and it's a really vibrant atmosphere and nobody's feeling shy that there's somebody that's 5 years older or 8 years older doing a master's or a doctorate. And, you know, they're able to just be who they are. They're able to have a taste of the collegiate experience. We had a cheerleader. He was one of these guys that would do the flipping all the way across the basketball court, like over and over and over. We had a violinist who could actually play piccolo and flute, and like he loved to run around in the marching band. I've had students do, you know, join a cappella groups, pop a cappella groups, and invite me to their concerts. Students that have joined various clubs and had performances and invited me along to see those. Kids that are all of a sudden directing the musical, even though they're a string player. They get a chance to sort of experience all of that. And I think they value that opportunity. Having been to both, it's not as simple and easy as being at a conservatory. I like to say that if you're at a conservatory, you can kind of be a kid and do your thing and have fun being a college student and still be able to practice 4 hours a day. At a Vanderbilt, you're going to sacrifice some of that freedom.
Because of the academic expectations?
Because of the academic side and the more courses that you have to take. And so if you're going to get the 4 hours in, you're going to have to exhibit some self-control and maybe not go hang out for hours with your buddies on, you know, on weeknights and stuff. You're going to have to be pretty smart about how you budget your time.
What advice would you give to students preparing for college auditions then?
These days, the college process happens a lot earlier than for when you and I were doing this. And so the pre-screen part is a very important part of the process. And that usually happens, typically most pre-screens are due around December 1st.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So that does accelerate everything.
Yeah. The process has to begin earlier. I do also have some pre-college students, and certainly with my college students that are applying for master's programs, they need to really start thinking about their repertoire probably by March to April for that fall pre-screen, because it's no longer, I want to be sounding my best when I go audition in February. you can't take the pre-screen for granted. You've got to be sounding pretty much at the top of your game and submit something that's representative of your best playing. So the whole timetable is a little bit earlier. The idea of preparation these days, of course, you're relying on a teacher that's going to give you guidance, doing a lot of your own recording. You know, I tell my students these days that it's so easy to record. You've got your phone there. You know, the sound quality is not great, but it'll give you rhythm and pitch right away. And for this generation, recording should be kind of what a metronome was to our generation, like pop out a metronome, it's easy, blip, blip, blip. But for you all, your phone's right there. You know, I don't tell them you have to sit here and record your entire practice session and then go back and listen and take notes. I'm just saying, have the thing there. And like, and even if it's, I want to see how my D major scale is working. Is it what I think it is? And listen back and like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I'm missing this shift and this key area or whatever isn't quite right. Or I sometimes just say, just record an excerpt from a difficult piece, from a concerto or from whatever, and just kind of see, okay, yeah, my rhythm's working well. This is the rubato that I wanted and it's really happening. So I think there are a lot of tools for students to, I think as teachers, as you know, we always want our students to become their own best teachers. Having recording at their fingertips is so valuable. So I think going along and then with the pre-screen and then with the live audition, you always want your best playing right away. Sometimes I'll help my students make pre-screen recordings and I'm pretty merciless. If anything goes wrong in the first 40 seconds, 45 seconds, like stop, we're doing it again, you know, stop, stop, stop. There's no like, I did the take, a couple of things I didn't like kind of at the beginning, but I make up for it later. Well, later may not happen. Later might be they've turned it off and they've moved on to the next thing. So I think when you record and then also when you go into the audition, you want to make sure the very beginning of what you're going to do is the best playing that you have. And most places where you go audition, they'll always let you choose what you begin with. And so you want to know what that's going to be going in. And that's probably got to be the best thing on your program.
Yeah, that's great advice. We're going to pause for a short break. To all of you other cello Sherpas out there nurturing future generations of cellists or any other instrument, we have a new feature just for you. Many of the topics we will cover here on the Cello Sherpa podcast are worthy of further discussion, so we wanted to let you know about teaching points we'll be posting on our website after each podcast. We develop these materials with you and your students in mind. Feel free to copy them, hand them out, and use them as assignments to be completed after listening to our podcast, or just tools for raising the level of professionalism in your studio classes, rep classes, orchestra, or band programs. Please visit our website for more information and click on the Teaching Points tab. And as always, give us some feedback on what you'd like to learn more about on the Cello Sherpa podcast. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. This helps our rankings and makes it easier for others to find us. What would you say you look for in students auditioning for your studio?
Well, it's a variety of things. I mean, these days, a lot of students they'll work with you beforehand. They'll come visit campus and schedule a lesson, that kind of thing. And that's nice to kind of get to know the teacher. Do know that they're getting to know you as well when you do that. So I don't ever recommend my students going out and taking along a piece they've only been playing for 2 or 3 weeks just to get some ideas on it. No, like you kind of need to go into these lessons playing something that's showing you at a very representative ability of what you're capable of. So I get to know somebody in the lesson beforehand, but then in the actual audition, I'm looking for obviously technical ability and fluidity and precision, but I'm also really looking for somebody who is a musician, has creativity and ideas, hopefully informed by what the composer has on the page. I'm a little forgiving if somebody's taking maybe too many liberties versus somebody who's not taking any and just very, very dry. So I'm looking for that. And ultimately, and I don't know how other people feel about this, but ultimately I'm looking for somebody that I want to look forward to teach every week for 4 years. I mean, you know, when I first got to Vanderbilt, it was like, okay, I want the best players. Like, if you're good, come. And it's changed. I mean, now that we have such a strong program and everybody that comes in auditions are so good, my thinking has flipped a little bit. I'm thinking partially now, well, how do I want to spend the next 4 years of my life? And so I'm looking for somebody who's sort of responsive when I speak to them and the lessons, and seem like they're going to be a great person in our studio, that the studio atmosphere is important to me. Who am I going to look forward to teaching? Well, somebody that's going to value what I have to say and maybe think about it and then actually implement. Somebody who's a thoughtful musician and has their own ideas so that we can discuss. Somebody who listens carefully and takes care of their own technique, but is really listening for the basic execution things that happen with the cello, versus somebody who comes in who might be very musical, but you know, has a lot of sloppy tendencies. I'm not completely militant about those, because I do think it's important for us to meet all kinds of different people and for the studio to have different personalities. But I think in the end, it does come down a little bit to who would I like to work with for 4 years.
So it sounds like the trial lesson is really important then, because you get to know somebody a little bit ahead of time. And you can see also, and I can tell you from my perspective with sending my own students out for trial lessons, I'm glad you gave us the tip about being more experienced with a piece, because I've had the attitude sometimes with a student that, well, if you bring something you've only been working on for a little bit, it's a good opportunity to see what this student or this teacher can work with you on. But I think it's good to hear the other perspective, because now I know, okay, well, maybe I should send them with repertoire that's a little more under their fingers. But in that experience of a trial lesson, you really get to see, number one, if they respond to you. And then number two, if they come back 6 months to 12 months later for the audition, how much has that person improved? And I would imagine that must be a key indicator for you too, to see what sort of growth you can get out of a player in 4 years.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And there'll be times when you'll be in those lessons and on the fence think, you know, because I mean, we all play this game a little bit, like, okay, do I think this person might be right here at Vanderbilt, even though it could be a year from their actual audition date. But then when they come back and they impress you at that point, and I do take notes, because I can't remember people these days, and there's too many students coming for lessons. So I do write notes, and I'll go back and I'll look and I'll see. And so when somebody really makes that leap, that's exciting. I'm excited for them, but I'm also, you know, for myself thinking, oh, okay, well, is this somebody that I would want for the next 4 years? Well, if they can show me that, then certainly I want to be sort of part of somebody's life, and I want to feel like I'm making a difference. And if somebody's going to come and they're not really going to listen to what I have to say, or they're not going to show any sort of signs of improvement, that's frustrating, you know. And then, or I'll even remember that in a prospective student lesson, I'll say something very specific and I'll remember that in the audition, and then they've completely ignored it or they've forgotten. I'm like, okay, well, it's understandable, but if they actually remember, then I file that away, because that's not as common.
Right. When I got the opportunity to visit your studio a few years ago and work with your studio with a lot of excerpts, which I really enjoy that experience, I was very impressed by the fact that you have your students prepare every semester a very standard list of orchestra excerpts. And I was wondering, because going to school where I went, that wasn't the standard at the conservatory I was at. As a matter of fact, my first year at Manhattan School of Music, if I wanted excerpts, I had to sign up for Nathan Stutch's class. And I did, because he was such a legend. But I came in as a freshman and he looked at me and he basically asked me why I was there already. He said, I don't teach freshmen. And he had no expectation of students younger than junior or senior year taking his class. So he gave me a C and told me I didn't understand the repertoire. But I was curious, when you first started there, when did you decide to do this with the students, to really standardize an excerpt list and work with the students in that way?
Well, I will admit that it was not my idea.
Oh, wow.
So I stole this idea from my friends at Carnegie Mellon, or at least I don't think I actually even talked to them directly about it, but one of their students was studying in the summer. And so I think they relayed it. But I thought that was just a great idea, to basically have the set repertoire every single semester, rather than sort of when I was coming up, they'd sit there and have you learn, you know, whatever they were going to be playing that semester, which is fine. But knowing that cello, I mean, we're sort of lucky. We're not like the violins where the list is sprawling of what might be asked. We've got some that are almost on every single list. And so, you know, I was like, okay, we're going to have some Beethoven 5, Brahms 2, Mendelssohn Scherzo, Don Juan, you know, and you're just going to, every semester, you're going to have to like get this ready for an audition again. And then by the time you graduate, you'll have prepared it 8 times. Of course, we don't have enough time to listen to them all. So, you know, they're like, oh, I thought you were going to ask for Don Juan this semester. And like, oh, no, you know, whatever. They don't really know, but at least they prepared it and got it back in their fingers and got it going. There's another built-in thing, which is it sort of favors the ones that have been there for a little while. So, I mean, I think everybody needs to win their position on merit, but I do value seniority and I do value experience. And I think this sort of has that component kind of built into the process. And I try to be pretty transparent about how it all works. And I think the students see that I don't play favorites, that any given semester, somebody could be at the top or the bottom. It just depends on how you did. But certainly this process will favor the older kids a little bit who have prepared it, you know, 2.5 years or something.
Do you find that all the studio is receptive to it, that they enjoy this process?
Let's see. You know, I don't know. I guess I haven't really asked them about it. Like, I think they are sort of appreciative that they kind of know what's going to happen. Once in a while, I'll swap something out. So like if they're going to do like a Brahms 3 or something, I'm like, okay, well, that's an excerpt that's often asked too. So, you know, maybe I'll take out the Brahms 2 this semester and I'll swap that in. I think they, you know, I think they value having that constant reinforcement of the standard stuff.
Yeah. And it's great to get out with your bachelor's degree and have an understanding of the most standard excerpts when you're there, because a lot of the excerpt work I did came after I got out of school, mm-hmm. is when I really started focusing on it. Well, we really appreciate your time today. I was wondering, where can people find you on social media?
Unfortunately, not very many places. So I'm pretty behind on that. So all I have really is just my page that they have at Vanderbilt for me. So it's at the Blair School of Music Vanderbilt website. Although I am going to be getting a website in the works, but I don't have an address yet.
Okay. Well, you'll let us know.
Yeah. You can just look me up at Vanderbilt and email me, and hopefully I'll have something pretty soon.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Well, thank you, Joel. This is wonderful. What an opportunity. And I'm honored that you asked me to join you. And already, even though it's the third one, some great company. So I look forward to listening to those as well.
Thank you so much for listening to our third episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. We look forward to our next episode, where we interview Rainer Udykus, principal cellist of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Be sure and subscribe to the Cello Sherpa podcast, so you'll be notified when our next episode posts. Today's episode was produced, recorded, and mostly edited by Joel Dallow, with some much-needed assistance from Mark DiClaudio at 3Wire Creative. You can find more information about them at 3, and that's the number 3, wirecreative.com.